Laura, much to discuss. Where would you like to begin?
The Defence Forces, I think, Philip. Always a good place to start.
And I believe we have to thank Jackie Lambie for her initiative in getting this Royal Commission up.
Well, Jackie Lambie, a lot of veterans, a lot of Defence Force families, mothers of children who've taken their own lives, who've pushed really hard for this. A lot of people have really been pushing and pushing and pushing to get a Royal Commission into the rate of suicide in the Defence Forces and what can be done about it. The fact that more people are dying by suicide than actually in military engagements in recent years. And finally, the government bowed to the inevitable, in, you could say, today, or essentially tried to claim that it was taking the initiative when for the last 6 months or so it's been saying, look, we don't think we need a Royal Commission. What we need is an ongoing national commissioner to look at this issue. And everybody else said, no, not good enough. That's not what we need. We need a proper Royal Commission to look into this. So the Prime Minister's announced that today and then said that his idea of the National Commissioner would be sort of proposed to be put in place even as the Royal Commission was beginning to implement whatever the Royal Commission eventually found.
Laura, any hint as to who the National Commissioner or indeed the Royal Commissioner might be?
There might be, Philip, but my aspidistra hasn't travelled that far.
Okay, I just thought I'd ask. But, of course, the phenomenon of ex-servicemen committing suicide is global. We've often talked about it in other programs in terms of its impact in the US, but it's really quite extraordinarily high, isn't it?
It is. It's really the most terrible thing, and it just seems weird because it's not like we haven't known about it for some time, and we seem to have been in these particularly high rotation, long wars in Afghanistan, obviously, and to a lesser extent in Iraq and other places, which have really taken a huge toll in terms of PTSD on our defence forces. So you really can't see why it's taken this long for us to actually start to look at the issue seriously.
Well, staying on military matters, last week the government announced that the remaining service personnel in Afghanistan would be withdrawn by September, following, of course, in the boots off the ground example of the US.
That's right. So there's only 80 Australians still left in Afghanistan. But as you say, we're getting out when the Americans are getting out. I don't know why exactly we have to wait that long, but there's probably a really good reason. And I think the sort of summation of what happened in Afghanistan and what we have left behind, whether collectively there's been any difference made to the people of Afghanistan as opposed to issues about whether it stopped Al-Qaeda and all the other things it's been sort of said to be doing over the intervening years is really unclear. It was sort of interesting to see the Prime Minister come out and read out the names with much emotion and breaking down of the servicemen who, and possibly women, I'm sorry if I'm not sure, the service women who were killed there as well. But he read out those names with much emotion last week, which is understandable. But
well, he didn't.
Why
he didn't.
We were there
in the first
he didn't place
tackle.
Has got to be assessed.
He didn't tackle with any emotion the issue of Indigenous deaths in custody. We recognise the 30th anniversary of that Royal Commission with Pat Dodson last week, but as far as I can see, no reference to it from the Prime Minister.
No, it was sort of shuffled off to the Minister for Indigenous Affairs, Ken Dow. I'm having a complete nervous breakdown here. The Minister for Indigenous Affairs on last week, and nobody was talking about this issue much except in sort of that general terms of, oh, yes, well, it's really terrible. And it was essentially at the same time as the Prime Minister was getting upset about people who'd been killed in action in Afghanistan. But even though there'd been a call by some of the families of people who died in custody to meet with the Prime Minister, and that call has been out there since before Christmas. There's been no suggestion that he would do that, or that the government wants to escalate or accelerate or put any focus on this issue at all.
Well, let's remind the listener, and indeed ourselves, of the 470 plus Indigenous deaths in custody over the last 30 years.
And Philip, it's extraordinary that the sorts of things that we're still talking about is removing hanging points from cells. Now, obviously, people make the correct point that the big issue is why people are being incarcerated for fairly, you know, piddling offences by standards of the way white people would be treated in this country. But just even something really simple like that, sort of these statements that come out from state and federal jurisdictions saying things like, oh, yes, well, we're really continuing to look at, you know, getting rid of hanging points in cells. And you're thinking 30 years later, you're still thinking about that, or you're still even having to look at it. It's just extraordinary.
Okay, back to Afghanistan. The flow on from the Brereton report continues as our shiny bright new defence minister has announced that he will be overruling a very significant decision by the head of the ADG.
Look, I think this is a really extraordinary story, Philip. Peter Dutton has announced that he's not going to follow the recommendation of the Brereton inquiry, which was looking at alleged war crimes in Afghanistan by Australian forces, and that was to revoke the unit citation, which sort of looked at the, which was to look at the work of one particular group, which came under particular fire from the Brereton inquiry, and I mean, to do this, he has overruled the recommendation and the decision of the Chief of the Defence Force, Angus Campbell, in his first major action as Defence Minister. Now,
but that's pretty typically Duttonian, isn't it? He likes toss the odd grenade.
A cynic, Philip, would observe that the SAS is based primarily in Perth, where they now think there are a couple of seats that are in trouble because of various things, including the likely future of Christian Porter. Whatever happens to him, he hasn't been having a good run of things, shall we say. The coalition is worried about its high watermark of seats in Western Australia and Queensland, where there are also a lot of seats which are very militarily based. It's very hard not to see this in those terms, especially when Peter Dutton talks in terms like this doesn't pass the pub test to remove the citation from the whole unit. Of course, you should remove it from people who are individually charged, but you know, it's unfair to remove this citation from the whole group. Now, both the Brereton inquiry, which was headed by a very senior judge, and Angus Campbell, who has experience in the SAS, apart from the army in general, they understand exactly what that unit citation is about, and were recognising in saying that it should be stripped of the unit that there is a collective responsibility for a unit that has to be taken here, and were trying to send out a really important signal about culture going forward and the responsibility of individual units collectively to look at their own behaviour. So I think this is a really huge, for a government that's been so closely associated with the military, and, you know, for example, it's bringing in somebody from the military, from the Navy, to run their new rejigged COVID vaccine scheme, which is what they is their go-to position on everything, bring in somebody from the military. So for them to make this significant break and to reject the position of the Chief of Defence Force, I think is going to have really big shakedown ramifications, whether it get some votes on the ground or not. I think it's a really bad sign for them to be sending to the military establishment.
It's interesting. We also recruit most of our Governor-Generals from the same source, but Angus Campbell must be furious, but of course he'll have to just salute and cop it.
Well, he might. He probably will. He's a very distinguished soldier, and I think he's always proved to be his own man. So it'll be really interesting to see how he deals with this, and how it is worked out through the system from here on in. I mean, there have been a lot of criticisms of the Brereton inquiry recommendations and findings by people on the past and present military ranks who've said, look, it's not, it didn't look at the higher ranks and who was accountable for what happened in Afghanistan. But nonetheless, I think it's still a really huge sort of move in the relationship between this government and this side of politics and the military establishment, which is really the only sort of public institution, if you like, that has not been under assault other than the intelligence agencies since Howard came to office, really, by the coalition. The rest of the public sector has really sort of been left to its own devices, but the military and intelligence agencies have been sacrosanct and have been given a lot of extra cash along the way.
We must report, of course, that the Prime Minister did make it clear to Hadley on 2GB, and I quote, "We shouldn't be punishing the 99% for the sins of the 1%.
Yeah, that's what he said.
Breathtaking. Now, talking about breathtaking, let us take a deep breath and consider climate change. The Biden conference is looming, and 7:30, I guess, we'll be focusing.
We've got a four-part special this very week, Philip. It started tonight and looked at the effects of climate change in the Torres Strait, which where the islands are sinking. But Joe Biden, I think, is really it's yet another example of just how much of a game changer his administration is proving to be. He's essentially expected to double the ambition of the Obama administration in terms of emissions reductions in the lead up to the Glasgow conference at the end of this year, and may as early as this week at this virtual conference of leaders talk about trying to get US emissions 50% below 2005 levels, which is twice as much as Barack Obama committed to in Paris just a few years ago. So that plus the fact that he's been talking, that the Biden administration has been talking to the Chinese and they've made some agreements about all these things, really starts to put the pressure on Australia. It's not just a rhetorical pressure, but if these two administrations start really changing their technologies and revamping their economies to be cleaner, that obviously has implications for a fossil fuel exporter like Australia, and we've really got to get our act together.
Will the Aspidistra be hiding at the National Cabinet?
National Cabinet, it's becoming common as muck now, Philip. We're having two of them a week, but the Aspidistra doesn't really need to be there because we do get a fair bit of the information out, which is the value of having several governments there at the one time. But the National Cabinet also has the advantage of giving the Prime Minister some cover to completely revamp his flailing COVID
you
vaccine
said,
rollout.
Did you say flailing or failing?
I think I could have said both. Just tick the box, Philip. I think it's doing both at the moment. So I think he's today announced that they're going to completely rejig things. The mass vaccination centres, which he was poo-pooing only about 2 weeks ago, which the state governments were talking about, are now on the table. They're now looking at using all that AstraZeneca, which they can't give to younger people, to vaccinate everybody over 50 very quickly. They're rejigging all of the way these things are going to work. But the big problem is that there's been such a drop-off in confidence in the whole system that just at the very time we start to see sort of more vaccine becoming available, GPs' practices are reporting huge numbers of cancellations amongst people who think, I might just leave it for the moment and I'm not getting vaccinated. So that's going to be a big concern.
And this is in the context of the USA under Joe Biden reaching 50% of vaccination, and we're less than 6%.
And the UK, I think, has probably got even higher percentages, I suspect. But yeah, no, it's not quite. The fact that it's not just a supply issue, but the fact that there are so many sort of confused signals on how the distribution system is working, which I think is really reprehensible about the way this has unfolded.
I now, before I let you go, wish to spend just a moment with you doing a riff on Andrew Peacock, who I knew quite well, and he wasn't a bad bloke. He was a wet, of course, and there's no room for them in the Liberal Party these days.
Oh, I don't think they actually exist technically anymore. You know, they call them something different, but there aren't really wets. But you know, Andrew Peacock, of course, was the one who was going to make it the colt from Kooyong in Menzies' old seat. The man with the mostest and all that sort of stuff. His great passion was actually foreign policy, and I think he was regarded as being, you know, a good foreign minister when he eventually became one. But of course, the wet versus dry division between him and John Howard essentially rendered the Liberal Party pretty ineffective against the Hawke governments, Hawke and Keating governments, for a very long time. The internal warfare over policy, the personal enmity between the two of them, just kept the coalition out of office for a very long period of time, and which is unfortunate. Andrew Peacock, as you say, very amicable bloke, and you know, proved to be a very good campaigner against Bob Hawke, who was pretty formidable in his own right in 1984 and 1990, but was not able to get the coalition over the line, and thus his fortunes were written.
Our heart goes out to his three daughters and his third wife, and to Shirley MacLaine. Thank you, Laura Tingle, Chief Political Correspondent, 7:30.